Via remote, this is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown. U.S. President Donald Trump is threatening not to sign a massive year-end bill passed by lawmakers that includes a $900 billion coronavirus aid package and $1.4 trillion in annual government funding. Trump complained in a video tweeted out Tuesday night that the bill didn't deliver enough aid to Americans. The bill provides for a $600 payment to most Americans. Trump said he is asking Congress to increase the direct payments to Americans to $2,000 or $4,000 for a couple. Trump also is asking Congress to get rid of the wasteful and unnecessary items from the legislation and to send him a suitable bill. President-elect Joe Biden expressed empathy with struggling families and applauded Congress for passing the coronavirus aid bill, adding that it was a down payment on a broader relief bill he plans to introduce when he takes office on January the 20th. United States health officials are trying to tamp down fears about a mutant strain of the coronavirus that's spreading rapidly in the United Kingdom. Reports of the new virus prompted dozens of countries across the globe to shut down travel from the UK over the past 2 days. The fear of the variant comes as the United States faces a surge in new infections that is overwhelming some hospitals. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control said on Tuesday that the UK coronavirus variant had not yet been detected here in the United States. U.S. Health Secretary Alex Azar told media network Fox News that the Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna vaccines should be effective at preventing illnesses from the mutant strain. For more news, please join us at voanews.com. Via remote, this is VOA News. The leading U.S. infectious disease expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci, Tuesday received the initial dose of the newest COVID-19 vaccine alongside other federal health leaders who helped oversee its development. Fauci received the vaccine developed by jointly the NIH, National Institutes of Health, and U.S. pharmaceutical company Moderna, which was just approved for emergency use last week. The vaccinations are part of a broader government effort to bolster public confidence in the safety of the two COVID-19 vaccines recently cleared by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. President-elect Biden says it will take months to roll back some of President Trump's actions on immigration, including restrictive asylum policies. Susan Rice, Biden's incoming domestic policy advisor, Jake Sullivan, his pick for national security advisor, as well as Biden himself, warned that moving too quickly could create a new crisis at the border. An election system worker driven into hiding by death threats has filed a defamation lawsuit against President Trump's campaign and his lawyers Rudy Giuliani and Sidney Powell. Also included in the lawsuit, some conservative media figures and outlets. Eric Coomer is security director for Dominion Voting Systems. Dominion has been named by President Trump and his supporters in baseless charges that they helped rig the election in President-elect Biden's favor. President Trump on Tuesday pardoned 15 people, including Republican allies. Trump announced a pardon for George Papadopoulos, his 2016 campaign advisor, whose conversation helped trigger the Russia investigation that overshadowed Trump's presidency for nearly 2 years. Trump commuted the sentences of 5 others. Hong Kong pro-democracy activist and media tycoon Jimmy Lai applied for bail in high court Wednesday after he was denied bail at the magistrate on Saturday. He was charged under the city's national security law on suspicion of colluding with foreign forces. Lai is the most high-profile person out of more than 24 charged under the sweeping law since it was imposed by Beijing back in June. And Israel's divided government has collapsed, triggering the country's 4th election under 2 years. Parliament had faced a midnight Tuesday deadline to pass a budget, but after failing to do so, the Knesset was automatically dissolved. The elections are now scheduled for March 23rd. For more news, please join us at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, December the 23rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The UN Human Rights Commissioner says violations of international law are endangering civilians in Ethiopia's Tigray region.
Witnesses described artillery strikes on the town of Humera on the border with Eritrea between the 9th and the 11th of November. We interviewed several people from the town who alleged that shells launched from Eritrea had hit residential areas and the hospital.
Meanwhile, the UN Refugee Agency has issued an urgent appeal for Ethiopian refugees fleeing conflict in Tigray. The U.S. military assures Somalia of continued support, and Ugandan police arrest a lawyer for opposition presidential candidate Bobi Wine.
We are working within our mandate to carry out investigations, especially where there are allegations, regardless of whether you're a human rights activist, a lawyer, or any ordinary human being.
South Africa sees a new COVID-19 variant, but urges citizens not to panic. And a group of Senegalese women supply solar power to under-equipped rural clinics. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, is warning that civilians in Ethiopia's Tigray region are in extreme peril amid allegations of widespread violations, some possibly amounting to war crimes. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
It is difficult to verify many of these allegations and to gauge the extent of human suffering in Tigray because of the ongoing communications blackout in many areas. Human Rights Chief Bachelet is calling for unhindered access to the region by independent human rights monitors to assess conditions, protect civilians, and bring perpetrators of crimes to justice. The High Commissioner spokeswoman Liz Throssell says the Human Rights Office has received consistent information pointing to violations of international humanitarian law and human rights law by all parties to the conflict.
And these include artillery strikes on populated areas, the deliberate targeting of civilians, extrajudicial killings, and widespread looting. Among the accounts, witnesses described artillery strikes on the town of Humera on the border with Eritrea between the 9th and the 11th of November. We interviewed several people from the town who alleged that shells launched from Eritrea had hit residential areas and the hospital.
Throssell says the Ethiopian army and the regional Amhara forces and militia reportedly took control of Humera. They allegedly killed civilians and looted the hospital, banks, businesses, supermarkets, and private houses. She cites several other shocking incidents, the worst reportedly being the alleged mass killing of several hundred people, mainly Amharans in Maikadra on November 9th.
The High Commissioner has previously stressed that if civilians were deliberately killed by a party or parties to the conflict, these killings would amount to war crimes, and there need to be independent, impartial, thorough and transparent investigations to establish accountability and ensure justice.
Throssell says her office also has received information, as yet unverified, concerning the presence of Eritrean troops in Tigray, their involvement in the hostilities, and related serious violations of international law. The Ethiopian government has denied that Eritrean troops are involved in the conflict. Before the conflict began 7 weeks ago, some 96,000 Eritrean refugees were sheltering in four camps in Tigray. Since then, many have fled the camps in fear of safety. Earlier this month, UN High Commissioner for Refugees Filippo Grandi said his agency had received many disturbing reports of Eritrean refugees in Tigray being killed, abducted, and forcibly returned to Eritrea. Around the same time, the United States said it believed Eritrean troops were active in Ethiopia and called for them to be withdrawn. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The United Nations Refugee Agency and 30 humanitarian groups have issued an urgent appeal for funds to help Ethiopian refugees from the Tigray region and people in their host countries for the next 6 months. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
So far, refugees fleeing conflict in Ethiopia's northern province of Tigray have sought refuge in neighboring Sudan. However, the UN Refugee Agency says that is likely to change. The agency says refugees who reportedly are being prevented from leaving Ethiopia might try to flee to Djibouti and Eritrea instead. The multi-agency appeal launched Tuesday aims to support the three governments and others in the region in facilitating access to asylum and the provision of life-saving aid for those forced to flee. Aid agencies note a significant slowdown in the number of Ethiopians seeking asylum in neighboring Sudan. UNHCR spokesman Andre Mahetric says the total has now topped 52,000.
Despite the number of new arrivals dropping more recently to some 500 a day, aid agencies are dealing with a full-scale humanitarian emergency in a very remote area that has not seen such a large influx in decades.
Mahetic says funding will pay for a number of critical activities, including registration and documentation, the decongestion of sites in border areas, and transfer of refugees to new settlements.
Currently, many refugees remain in overcrowded conditions without proper facilities, and there continues to be a shortage of medicine and other supplies. We have seen a huge demand for family tracing and reunification, education, and for child-friendly spaces and nutritional programs.
Spokesman Mahetic says more than 20,000 refugees already have been relocated away from the border areas to Rakuba camp, and work has begun on a new site located even further inside Sudan to accommodate more refugees. Other priorities included in the appeal are for food, health, shelter, and specific protection needs for women and girls at risk, unaccompanied minors, the disabled, and the elderly. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The United States military sent a massive warship and an amphibious assault ship to Somali waters for an operation that will support repositioning of hundreds of U.S. troops. With concerns emerging that the withdrawal will embolden al-Shabaab militants, the United States military is assuring Somali authorities of continued support in developing Somali forces and degrading the al-Shabaab militant group. The U.S. military in Africa, known as AFRICOM, says they are not going anywhere. They are simply repositioning. Colonel Christopher Carnes is the AFRICOM spokesperson.
So our tasks and our commitment to our partners remain unchanged. I think it's important as far as the repositioning of U.S. forces. Al-Shabaab has proven it can adapt, but we also have the ability to adapt and will do so. It's important to maintain a strategic element of surprise. Like I said, our tasks remain the same. How we go about doing them will adjust, but support certainly continues.
Can you explain that strategy if possible?
So, you know, what we want to be able to do, you know, like any military operation, is to maintain operation security and force protection. So in terms of providing the particulars, I'm unable to do that. But what I can assure you of is U.S. Africa Command will continue to support Somalia by developing Somali forces. We'll continue to conduct counter violent extremist organization operations. And I think what you saw with our latest airstrikes demonstrate a resolve and a commitment to ensuring that we continue to disrupt al-Shabaab's ability to conduct operations in Somalia, but also to make it more difficult for them to conduct external operations against East African partners and also against U.S. interests.
Can you also talk about how this repositioning of the troops is going to affect other assistance you have been providing, done up, including financial support, logistics? Can you talk about that as well?
So as it relates to repositioning of forces, we've demonstrated throughout the course of U.S. Africa Command's history and more broadly wherever we conduct operations around the globe, an ability to adapt to situations, to be able to get after mission objectives in a manner that will achieve the objectives that we set forth. You know, we still aim to impact the ability of al-Shabaab, to impact their ability to conduct external operations against U.S. interests in East Africa. And you know, they've demonstrated at least a desire to attack the U.S. homeland. We recognize by continuing to place pressure on this network is critically important.
Colonel Christopher Kahns, a spokesperson for the U.S. Africa Command. He was speaking with reporter Haroon Maruf of the U.S. Somali Service. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, December 23rd. Ugandan police say their task force of security and financial intelligence has arrested a lawyer for opposition presidential candidate Robert Chakulayi, popularly known as Bobi Wine. Police spokesperson Fred Anega says Nicholas Opio, founder of the human rights defense organization known as Chapter 4 Uganda, was arrested on allegations of money laundering and related malicious acts.
What we can basically tell you is that it is true that our task team of security together with the financial intelligence unit this evening, the arrest of one of the last Nicholas, who is the subject of the investigation, actually in an alleged money laundering and actually fraud scheme and other related malicious acts. So the task team has lines of inquiry that they are actually investigating. They are also looking at the actions of the funds and how the proceeds, and also how the proceeds have been dispatching these proceeds. So it is basically that, and we want to give opportunity to this joint task team to carry out its work, and then we shall be coming up with a detailed update in due course. So it was just something as simple as that. He's in the custody of the police, and the investigations were actually progressing well. So I don't see any big problem that is arising out of that, because we are working within our mandate to carry out investigations, especially where there are complaints, where there are allegations, regardless of whether you're a human rights activist, a lawyer, or any ordinary human being. So
who gave the orders for the police to make this arrest? I'm saying this because the opposition is saying that this is part of a plan by the government to intimidate the opposition.
There is not anything like that. What I've indicated to you is that once we established that there were some transactions and actually investments that were suspect, then we really had to come out. We are jointly coordinating investigation with the financial intelligence unit. There is nothing about it. So he has to come out and explain to us and clear his name. We managed to inform the lawyers that he's in the custody of the Special Investigations Division. So it's a matter of them coming out clean, explaining themselves. So it is not anything political, but the fact remains that their claims of money laundering, wire fraud, and these are matters that attract investigations. It's not anything political. Fact remains that he's been receiving funds under suspicious arrangements, and that caused for this investigation. So let it remain like that. The opposition can also prove their claim, but we believe that what we are doing remains for the suspect to bring out information to help us prove his claims. As simple as that.
That was Fred Anega, Ugandan police spokesperson, speaking with us from the capital, Kampala. Ugandan opposition presidential candidate Robert Chakulayi, popularly known as Bobi Wine, says the arrest Tuesday of human rights lawyer Nicholas Opio is yet another example of government's campaign against civil society and opposition. Opio was arrested Tuesday alongside other lawyers. The police say Opio, founder of the human rights defense organization known as Chapter 4 Uganda, was arrested on allegations of money laundering and related malicious acts. Lena Zegriga Waru is the deputy president of Bobi Wine's National Unity Platform Party.
Just about 2 hours ago on the social media, as I was heading to Koboko in the West Nile region to meet with our team on the ground to encourage them on social media, I read about the arrest by plain clothed security operatives of a team of lawyers. Among others prominent is Nicholas Opio, the executive director of Chapter 4 Uganda, a very prominent outspoken human rights lawyer, and also Tenua, who is right now heading the National Unity Platform political party human rights abuses desk, where we are recording statements and documenting the experiences of all kinds of human rights abuses. And then I also know there's another lawyer. There were other lawyers who were meeting in Kampala to hold some discussions.
The police said that he is arrested on allegations of money laundering. What does the movement make of that?
We have in place the financial whatever authority that not so long ago closed some civil society organizations. The New You, which is among other organizations, the Uganda Women's Network and also the NGO Forum, they were cleared by the Bureau to monitor elections, among others, and look at issues of civic education. So last week, these organizations were shut down. Their bank accounts have been frozen, and they are being investigated for carrying out suspicious activities of terrorism. And that is a very big crime in Uganda here. But as we talk now, these organizations, Uganda Women's Network, UONET, NGO Forum, the other organizations that consortium, their bank accounts are frozen, and in a way they are shut down. It manifests the closed space for civic participation in Uganda. The media crackdown, the media internationally and here are supposed to get a new accreditation from the UCC, the Uganda Communications Commission. We see also on our campaign trail the anti-terrorism group that are following us all over, brutalizing us. Last week, as we were with the president in the Karamoja region, our campaigns were cut short because there was an intention for them to arrest us in Karamoja and keep us there. So we had to cut short our stay for the campaigns in Karamoja, and we drove back to Kampala. So these are manifestations of the state pressing panic button. The people are speaking loud and in action.
Lena Zegriga Waru is the deputy president of Bobi Wine's National Unity Platform Party of Uganda. She was speaking with us from the capital, Kampala. South African health officials say the nation's second coronavirus wave is driven by a new variant of the infection, but they urge citizens not to panic. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
If there is one overarching message from authorities about the new coronavirus variant in South Africa, it is this. Don't panic. In recent days, South Africa has seen a strong second wave, with the government documenting about 9,000 new cases a day. That leaves the nation, Africa's epicenter for the virus, with nearly 350,000 confirmed cases since March and nearly 25,000 deaths. Health Minister Dr. Zweliem Kiese says epidemiologists expect to see a further rise as many South Africans return to work in January from a month-long summer holiday. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, Director General of the World Health Organization, says the new variant is no stronger than the original.
In the past few days, there have been reports of new variants of the COVID-19 virus in South Africa and the United Kingdom. Viruses mutate over time. That's natural and expected. The UK has reported that this new variant transmits more easily, but there is no evidence so far that it's more likely to cause severe disease or mortality.
Here's Mkhize, the health minister.
Right now, there's no need to change. There's no need to panic to think that there's some new treatment that we're going to need, or at this point to ask the question as to whether any of the treatment that has been used, is it going to be effective or not? At the moment, it has been effective even before we knew that there was a variant. So we want to keep that as a matter of reassurance to the public.
The chair of South Africa's advisory committee on the coronavirus, Dr. Salim Abdul Karim, says the nation's top sequencing lab found this new strain in about 90% of new cases. This, he stressed, is typical of viruses. They generally evolve to become more transmissible, but also less severe. He says the second wave is so far showing signs that it is spreading faster than the first wave. But is it stronger and deadlier? So far, he says, there are no signs of that. He also notes that experts are studying whether the new vaccines will work on the new variant. So far, he said the data is inconclusive. On Tuesday, the health department announced that the government had made a $19 million down payment to the International Vaccine Alliance. Those funds will go towards providing 6 million doses, which will cover about 10% of the population. Karim stressed that the single best strategy is to give the virus no quarter and starve it into submission.
The current diagnostics are still effective. Our current strategies of social distancing, hand hygiene, symptom checking, mask wearing, all of them remain the basic strategies of prevention for this virus.
South Africa's National Institute for Communicable Diseases has posted a list of frequently asked questions about the new variant on its website, www.nicd.ac.za. But here's what it comes down to. Wash your hands. Keep your distance from others. Stay home if you can. Essentially, treat this new strain the same as the old one. Remain calm and carry on. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
A group of women in Senegal have been supplying solar panels to light up country homes that are off the power grid. But with the outbreak of the COVID-19 pandemic and health care stretched, the women switched to supplying solar power to under-equipped rural clinics. Annika Hamishla reports from Fatick, Senegal.
Senegalese women adorned in colorful wax fabric clothes laugh and dance around the village of Chamanjago. They are celebrating because the local clinic that provides prenatal care will soon have electric lights and fans. Head nurse Isaka Dia says with more than 2,500 people from six villages, there are about eight births each month, many of which he attends to at night using only the light from his mobile phone. He says he's so happy. He feels like they can now work day and night, even in the heat. The remote region in western Senegal is off the electric grid, so the clinic will be powered by the sun. Since 2018, the woman-run El Solaire has been installing solar power in rural households. With the coronavirus pandemic stretching healthcare, the company began equipping remote clinics. Kelly Lavelle is the founder and executive director.
We've been just amazed at the reception we've seen today is a point in case. It's sad in a way that we've had to wait for COVID to hit for us to stop and think about the health clinics. But I'm really pleased that we've kind of managed to pivot this into an opportunity.
The organization also provides new skills for women like John Cha, El Solaire's women's coordinator. She used to scrape by with childcare and cleaning jobs. She says that although she could pay the rent before, she could not feed her family because she didn't have the means. Since the onset of COVID-19, the illness caused by the coronavirus, Cha and her coworkers have installed solar power lights, fans, and mobile phone chargers at 23 remote clinics. More than 1 million Senegalese lack access to power, according to USAID, and the World Health Organization says rates of maternal mortality are high. Umar Sam is a project evaluator with Senegal's Ministry of Women, Family and Child Protection. He says when women arrive to give birth in the night or in the day and all the machines are down, it's obviously a danger for the women in labor and for the newborn. Access to solar energy for these rural women can be life-saving, he says. And that, say the women, is progress worth celebrating. Annika Hammerschlag for VOA News, Kaolack, Senegal.
And that's it for this Wednesday, December 23rd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butt in Washington saying, have a good day.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bubu music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Hey, Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.